welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Lots of us in New Haven, or lots of our neighbors, are going hungry in New Haven this holiday season. A new report documents the state of hunger in New Haven. Today, some folks behind that study and people dealing with the problem are here in the WNHH studio to talk about it. Say good morning to a familiar voice on this station, Alicia Santilli from Connecticut State University these days, formerly from CARE, a coalition that dealt with these issues.
Right? Still with CARE.
Oh, you're still with CARE?
Mm-hmm.
But CARE is at Southern Connecticut.
Correct.
Now. Got it. Okay, it used to be at Yale. And then James Kramer, who's the executive director of the Loaves and Fishes Food Pantry.
Good morning.
At St. Paul and St. James Episcopal Church. A special thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. Welcome, folks, and thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Not the cheeriest topic, although we will be talking today about the good works of dealing with it, which has its own, joy, or at least mission encompassed in it. So there's a new report out. It's finding that 22% of New Haven is food insecure, which means at some point in a month they don't have enough money to buy food or have to choose between food and rent. Is that true, Alicia?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And that's compared to 12% statewide, 13% nationally. And it really is much more of an impact in some of our poorer neighborhoods. We have six low-income neighborhoods where 50.1% of the neighborhood is food secure. Does that mean half the people in Fairhaven, West River, West Hills, West Rock, The Hill, or Dixon-Hawville are going hungry part of the month?
In our six low-income neighborhoods, which are those that you just listed, it's actually 1 in 3. And among the Hispanic and Latino population in those six neighborhoods, it's 50%.
Oh, I had that other way. I had it backwards. Okay. And Alicia, if you don't mind moving the mic a little bit direct so you'd be right on it. We need to be real close. Maybe move it up toward your mouth.
More?
Tilt it. Okay. There you go. Right there. Okay. So, in the Hispanic, is that Hispanic citywide, 50.1%?
That's in the six low-income neighborhoods.
Wow. So, why is it higher among Latino people than other people in those neighborhoods? That's
a great question. We don't have data that, you know, kind of drives into that topic more deeply, but, you know, we can make some guesses based on our experiences out in the community, and I'm sure James might have some things to say about this as well. But I think it probably has to do with things like immigration status and not being able to access some of the benefits that are available to other people, and maybe fear of accessing benefits.
So out of five people living in New Haven,
mm-hmm.
and one-third of the people and half of the Latinos mm-hmm. in our poor neighborhoods, mm-hmm. every month miss some meals, don't have enough money to buy food?
Yeah, it's a series of questions that we use, that the USDA puts out, and it asks about whether or not people had enough money in the past 30 days or money to buy food in the past 30 days. And this particular data is from our 2015 survey, which is a random sample of households in those six low-income neighborhoods. So and it's weighted, so we feel like it's accurate.
What does it mean it's weighted?
There just some statistical analyses have been applied to make sure that it's representative of the whole population for mm-hmm. those neighborhoods. So we feel pretty confident that number is really accurate.
And how you get the citywide number? Do you also do the survey citywide?
That's from the Data Haven survey.
Data Haven is another organization town,
yes.
And they do.
Yeah.
And then do you how many people do you survey when you do these?
In the 2015 survey, it's about 1,200 people.
Oh, okay. That's a significant statistic.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's based, so it might be even worse since 2015, right?
Yeah,
I mean. Do you have a sense on that, or is it easy to believe that?
Not yet. Data Haven will be repeating their survey in 2018, so in about another year, less than a year. We'll have some updated information.
So you've been about this a while. I remember we were writing about, you wanted to say something, James?
Yeah, I just wanted to say anecdotally, I can kind of speak to what's happening right now. And so normally during the month, we, depending on what week it is, we have about 225 people come in to the food pantry the first week. And then all the way, it goes up every week until we hit usually about 300, 315 for the fourth week of the month. And we've been... Last month, we served more bags of groceries than we've ever served before. And then this month, in November, we've served more bags of groceries than we served last month. And so, anecdotally...
And how many years you've been doing this?
It's about 40 years.
Whoa. So, for the most ever in 40 years.
Yeah. And we topped up now the highest number of people that we've served or bags of groceries that we've served was 341, which is a huge uptick for us. And it feels like we're...
Is that in a week or in a...
In a week.
Yeah.
And just on a Saturday. So we're only open on Saturdays. But yeah, it is growing. The need is growing. And we are also getting more new people who are signing up. So every week we usually have about 20 people who sign up. And we've been getting anywhere between 50 and 60 new people signing up. And many of them are people who are from the hurricane.
Hmm.
Oh, so that's the latest, the hurricane in Mexico. I mean, Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico and the mm-hmm. earthquake in Mexico.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. How much have you seen with that?
I mean, it's just been a pretty big uptick. And so we're always trying to find more volunteers who speak Spanish. That kind
okay,
of thing.
So that's a need you have there.
Mm-hmm.
So just so people know what we're talking about with this new hunger report and your food pantry, fish loaves and fishes is a food pantry at St. James and St. Paul's. Mm-hmm. Did I say it backwards?
St. Paul and St. James.
And that's a church. Was that two churches at once combined? Is that why you have both?
No, it's always just been one, but they chose
and
to.
At the corner there of Chapel and Olive.
Yep.
And every Saturday you give out bags of groceries to people.
Mm-hmm. And we also give out clothing too. But
clothing. And do you have to qualify? Do you have to show that you're poor, or are you figuring if you're showing up, you're poor?
You have to sign a piece of paper that's a TFAP form. It's a federal form. And it just says that you make under a certain amount of money.
What is that amount?
That amount, it depends on how many people you have in your family. And so it's kind of a sliding scale.
Example?
I think it's $26,000, but please don't quote me on
if
that.
If you have a family.
For two people.
For two people, yep. Yeah. It's hard to eat on that.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So, Alicia, when you look at the numbers, is there a general sense of what incomes are needed not to be food insecure, not to go hungry in New Haven?
You know, I don't know that off the top of my head. I know there's been some calculations done by other groups that have shown for Connecticut, I believe, livable wage, I think, is somewhere around $18 to $20 an hour in order to be able to afford.
For full-time?
Yeah.
And does that include having health insurance or not? Because that's the biggie.
Yeah.
I mean, for, you know, family of four, that could be $20,000.
I think it's to cover basic necessities like housing, food, clothing, and I would assume health insurance as well.
Because if you don't have that, if you have that part-time job, then you don't get the benefits.
Right.
So, tell people what CARE is. That's an acronym.
Sure. Yeah. CARE stands for the Community Alliance for Research and Engagement. We've been around for a little over 10 years.
You started at the Yale School of Public Health?
Yeah, we started at the Yale School of Public Health, and about a year ago, we joined with Southern Connecticut State University. So I moved over to Southern and became the director, and we're housed within the School of Health and Human Services, which is a large school that encompasses several departments, such as social work, public health, nursing, exercise science. So there's a lot of opportunity to do interesting cross interdisciplinary kinds of work with different types of students.
So students involved. Right?
Mm-hmm,
why absolutely. Did you leave Yale?
Well, we didn't leave Yale. I like to say we're co-housed. And we still have a office based at Yale, and our director of research sits there. And so a lot of our research and evaluation activities are run out of the Yale office. And then our community engagement and kind of the next iteration of our engagement work is happening out of our Southern.
Because given our presence of universities here, research universities, often efforts to help people in need are tied up with academic research.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to understand it better to both make a case to get funding and to help look for solutions to understand a problem on a broader scale. Would you argue that's what you're doing with CARE?
We try.
So tell me about that.
So, our shift over to Southern has been interesting in that it's a better place from where we can do better community engagement.
Why is that? It's a little more remote. I mean, Yale's right there in the hill and the center of town, and you do have poor people in West Rock, but there you're still even a mile down the road there.
Right. One of the things that really drew me to Southern was the student population.
Okay.
It's a state university, so it's really a community university made up of people from this region and from the state predominantly. So it's a little bit easier, and they're people that are going to stick around. So oftentimes in our classrooms, we have students who grew up in New Haven or from New Haven. They really get New Haven, or they're from the region. And so it's a little bit easier to do community engagement work with that type of student population.
They're not just passing through.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And neither are you. You're here on WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven, Elisa Santilli and James Kramer, talking about a new study showing that a lot of people like them already knew that hunger has been growing in our community. The need has been quite great. So Loaves and Fishes has been around 40 years, James mm-hmm. Kramer. And it's in the basement. You also have the Sunrise Cafe every morning that gives meals there.
We do. That's actually run by a separate nonprofit who rents space from the church. And so that's Liberty Services, and they do an absolutely wonderful job.
Now, the church itself, was there talk about them closing down or?
As far as I know, they're not going to be closing. They're a thriving community of people who are committed to staying open. Yeah.
Where did I get that from? What was that?
I think as churches go through a transition countrywide, people are always thinking that there's a possibility that they might be closing.
Because they're an important anchor there. You also have the jazz, Saturday, Sunday Mass you got there?
We do, and there's a concert coming up next weekend, next week on Thursday, that's going to be...
So it's jazz, and it's based on New Orleans Second Line or
no? Oh, yeah.
So definitely. Tell me about that.
I don't know a lot about it. We have a great music director, but jazz is always a draw.
You march through the streets of Worcester Square and all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. Are you a member of the church?
I am not, actually. I go to First Presbyterian Church.
Oh, okay. But you've been running. So how long have you been running the food pantry?
Just since May.
Since May. Okay. Mm-hmm. What were you doing before that?
I was going to Yale Divinity School, but I've been interested in food advocacy work in New Haven for about 4 years now.
And you remember the Food Policy Council that the city set up?
I am not an official voting member, but I do attend all the meetings.
So you still count if you're there and you're thinking we don't really care about the votes.
Okay. Yes, absolutely.
So what's going on with the Food Policy Council? You set that up, I believe it was 2 years ago?
The council has been around since close to 10 years as well.
Oh, 10 years. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And what kind of work is it doing?
So we've gone through a big transition over the past couple of years. You might remember we put out a food action plan in 2012, and we had several policy initiatives that we were trying to push for the city to kind of move forward with. And one of our primary recommendations was to hire a food system director for the city, somebody who could be solely focused on food insecurity issues and other food system issues. And so we were successful in advocating for that. So we have a new food system director, Joy Johannes, who works out of City Hall. She's been in the position for over a year now. And so there's been a lot of reorganization about the council's role and how we function. And we've been going through kind of a growing period. This hunger data report has actually been one of the pieces of work that has come out more recently. And Joy has been running several sessions related to kind of strategizing and prioritizing some of the issues the city should be working on. And simultaneously, the council has been supporting that work. And we have a very active food access working group as part of the council. And it's made up of emergency food providers like James and others across the city.
And how many do we have? We have Jewish Food Family Services. They have a food pantry. They also go into the schools and three of the schools and deliver packets. And we have the Connecticut Food Bank, right?
So the Connecticut Food Bank provides food.
It's the provider. Yeah.
It provides food for many of the food pantries in the city and also some of the soup kitchens. But there are also a number of organizations who operate outside of them who aren't interested in taking federal money. Fish is... with the Connecticut Food Bank. Desk is a great...
Downtown Evening Soup Kitchen, mm-hmm. Steve Worland, right there on Temple Street.
Yep, and then the Community Soup Kitchen with David O'Sullivan.
They've been the long time.
They've been great.
Long distance runners, and they give the meals out, I guess the lunches at the mm-hmm. soup kitchen.
So breakfast is at Sunrise over at our church at Chapel and Olive, and then lunch is over...
And how many people a day come to those places?
It's around 120 to 150. Mm-hmm. And I know that they've experienced some growth, so it might be more like 180 now.
You know, it's interesting. We're such a foodie city, so all this very expensive restaurant mm-hmm. scene has exploded, mm-hmm. where people spend $30, $50. Some people spend more than that for dinner in New Haven, and there's sort of this art form to it, and it's drawn tourism. And at the same time, we have this growing number of people who can't just afford a basic meal.
Yeah.
Have an instinct.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's partially the paradox of Connecticut in general. We are one of the wealthiest states, and we have some of the deepest pockets of poverty right here in New
Haven.
What's
driving food security in New Haven? Is it unemployment? Is it housing problems?
Yeah, I mean,
is it healthcare?
It's poverty. I think if anybody gets anything out of this report, I think, and maybe it's not made clear enough, but the main takeaway is, people should be able to afford food, and they're not, people who are working aren't making living wages. So they might be working full time. They might be working more than one job, and they still can't feed their families.
And the food stamps, I know people on food stamps who, like, they can't buy fresh vegetables for the second half of the month if they're going to try to stretch that money.
Yeah, I mean, fresh produce tends to be a little bit more expensive, so families oftentimes have to make decisions about what kinds of foods they're going to get as they're trying to stretch their dollars. Through some qualitative interviews we've conducted as a follow-up to our survey, we reached back out to some of the people who identified as food insecure to dig a little bit deeper into what some of the issues were. And people have an amazing strategy where they know which pantries to go to mm-hmm. around the city that have good fresh produce that they're getting from the Connecticut Food Bank. So they strategize around getting those more expensive things from the food pantries and whatever else they can, okay. and then using their SNAP dollars to fill in. But
snapping,
I mean, it's
the food stamps. Yeah.
It's still not enough to get people through the month.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And that's definitely a thing I was going to remark before. There's about 62 food pantries in New Haven.
62 food pantries?
Yes.
There are 62 food pantries.
And there's one in New Hallville. And there's,
it's impossible to name all of them.
Yeah.
There's one in Reverend Martinez's church in the hill.
Yep. Yep.
62
yeah. There's 62 food pantries, and it is not uncommon for people to visit more than one because they're not able to get all their groceries at one, and many of the food pantries are not open every week. And if they are open every week, there's restrictions on how many times during the month people can visit them, just because there's not enough food to give out. And so that's, well, there's kind of two problems that we're looking at is people don't have enough money to buy food, and then the food pantry. So that's one of the things the Food Access Working Group with the New Haven Food Policy Council is working on, is how do we better streamline the distribution of free food to people so that people don't have to go to five or six places during the month to get to get the groceries that they need. How do we kind of figure out, like, this is the spot for one neighborhood, or the one or two spots for one neighborhood, so that people can better equip themselves. And this is a huge time cost for people. I don't think people on the outside understand how much of a time cost. We're pretty efficient. We have people go through, we have the 300-350 people go through our line in about an hour and a half. We're only open about an hour and a half, and we're pretty good about getting everybody through, but some people wait 2.5-3 hours to go through a food pantry line. And if you're doing that 5 or 6 times a month, that's a huge time cost to people. It's a job.
It's a job
just to get the food.
So if you do have a full-time job or a part-time job, the rest of your time is consumed with trying to figure out how to get these basic needs like food. So I think one important thing that we try and highlight in the report is that there is this amazing network of people and volunteers and organizations that come together to feed our hungry population. So with our food pantries and our soup kitchens, there's about 70 if you add in the soup kitchens. But at the same time, we're still not getting to all the hungry people. So as James was saying, figuring out, you know, how we streamline some of those services. So, and also I think another issue with having so many food pantries and soup kitchens, it gets really confusing. So there's a lot of either lack of information or misinformation, like kind of on the street, like about where you can go and when. So it's really hard. And I feel like maybe this is a role that the city can play, or some of our larger organizations, to make sure that we have accurate, up-to-date information and that it's getting down to the street level. So that's another part of our recommendation that we make.
All right. So you're talking about solutions here. You're not just talking about, you're talking immediate solutions, feed people, long-term solutions, streamed kinds, access. You got to deal with poverty, which might be a little bit above the scope of this work that you guys do, pointing it up. Any other structural changes need? Do you really think it's bottom line, in addition to like making sure everyone has food every day in New Haven, making sure we improve access and streamline the process so it's not so hard to get it in the near term? Long term, is there any substitute for dealing with underlying issues of poverty from employment and living wage and housing and health care? Is that basically what this is about long term?
Long term, yeah. It's about figuring out how do we finally solve poverty, getting people appropriate education and training so that they can be in good jobs.
And remember previous care reports we've covered here at the Independent, WNHH, you talked about having safe places to be outside, and whether it's kids playing or grown-ups walking or exercise. You talked about having access to affordable, healthful food through the corner stores. Any updates on those efforts?
Those efforts are so challenging. We ran a corner store effort for a little while at CARE, and really just came to the conclusion that we're a health research organization, not an economic development organization. So it was really challenging for us.
It was
us.
A noble experiment, because people talked about that for decades.
People
in
still
Haven.
Talk about it.
No, about how do you get the corner stores not only give you
right.
decent food, but not have it cost twice as much.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So again, you know, I think these are some areas where we just need some better leverage from, you know, our friends in economic development, you know, at the city level and elsewhere to help us figure out how to solve these problems. I think, you know, stepping outside of kind of the health focus and understanding that these issues are all intricately related, and how do we come together in an interdisciplinary way, you know, cross sector to address some of these issues, because economic development goes hand in hand with, you know, the corner stores and small businesses and other businesses in our community. And then that directly impacts mm-hmm. how people can access food. This is getting outdated now, but in 2009, when we did our asset map, we found in the 6 low income neighborhoods, there was an average of about 10 corner stores in each neighborhood. And those corner stores predominantly, I mean, I don't want to say anything bad about the corner stores.
Junk food.
They're
trying
cigarettes. To, yeah, and they're trying yeah. to make a buck, and, you know, they're business owners. They're trying
what,
to make
and they're selling what people
a living.
Want to buy, yeah.
Right. They're selling what people want to buy. But other communities have come together to do some creative problem solving around some of those issues.
I think you had a permanent impact mm-hmm. on Congress Market, didn't you, across from John C. Daniels School? When I go in there, I still see right at the front fresh fruits and vegetables displays.
Yeah, I do think that's a longstanding store who always had a focus on fresh produce.
A little more than a corner store.
Yeah. So we were able to kind of leverage. So I think that's a really good example of a kind of store that we need in more communities, like a really small grocery store that is selling food at affordable prices.
All right. And we're talking about the rise in hunger in New Haven, a new report telling us all about that. And we're speaking with Elisa Santilli of the CARE, based at Southern Connecticut University, and James Kramer of the Loaves and Fishes Food Pantry at Olive and Grand. So, James, you talked about Hurricane Maria and how that's boosted the numbers of people who are hungry. Any other causes recently that's made this spike, just how we're dealing with poverty in the state or rising cost of housing? Anything you notice in talking to people who come?
Yeah, I mean, I think anecdotally, And also structurally, there's been cuts or looming cuts to SNAP benefits and federal benefits too, and
those are the food stamps. SNAP,
mm-hmm. yeah. And so as those cuts happen, it trickles down to us, and we're kind of the next layer,
the backstop,
yeah, of who's going to be providing fresh fruits and vegetables, who's going to be providing food, and so I think as you know. This is a sad fact, but we've been on sort of a 10-year growth spurt in our economy since the bottom of the recession, and the next dip is coming. And if we're experiencing these kind of numbers during while we're still in growth, quote unquote growth, because the growth isn't for everyone, mm-hmm. When the dip comes, the numbers are going to grow again. And I think part of what we've been thinking about strategically is how are we going to be able to meet 500 people on a Saturday? And what does that look like for us? And what can we do to be prepared for it? Yeah.
And tell me about how each of you got involved in food policy. James, you talked about being at Yale Divinity School. You've been a CARE leader for quite a long time. How did you get interested in dealing with food policy?
Honestly, from our research. So at CARE, we really are interested
in... So what were you doing before you got involved with CARE?
Well... So I'm trained as a community organizer. I'm a social worker, trained as a community organizer. And I was in that role as a community organizer. I worked at the statewide level doing some organizing. I really started to understand how important research was in organizing communities and having accurate data so that we could try and change policy, either at the local or state or even federal level. So that's just an interest I started to pursue and was able to land a job doing research at Yale and found my way to CARE. after a couple of years.
And you do great work there. You really do Thanks. Combine the sort of data collection deal with real people and getting things changed.
Yeah. So my perspective has always been more from a community organizing perspective, which is a little bit of a square peg in a round hole over at Yale.
Sounds like you find a better home here in Southern Connecticut.
I think I
That's
have.
Great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And so just really using data, you know, back to the food action plan several years ago and now with the hunger report and other types of reports that we put out, getting data into the hands of policymakers and other community activists that we can use it in a positive way to make change. That's really the place that I come from. And so when we did our first survey in 2009, we've known, I think one of the values of CARES data collection is that a lot of communities don't have this kind of very neighborhood level mm-hmm. data. For the first time, we were able to say with certainty what some of the statistics are around some of these very, you know, difficult issues in our communities. And food security is one of the issues that, you know, we knew hunger was an issue in New Haven. I think many people knew that. We had a lot of anecdotal information, but we didn't really know the extent of it in truth with numbers. So when that kind of rose to the top for us as we were looking through all of our data. And there's so many issues. I mean, there's so many issues we could focus on, but food insecurity is one that really rose to the top for us. And so I sort of found my way to the Food Policy Council and started getting involved in the council and have been around ever since. So it was really motivated by our data.
James, where did you come from before Yale Divinity School?
I've been bouncing around for a while. But previous to this, I was living in the Congo for 3 years teaching high school. But in all the places that I've lived, food is a huge part of everybody's everyday, and I've really appreciated the hospitality, and that's one of the big things that we talk about at Loaves and Fishes is offering people hospitality. And I think that has driven me to where we are today. I mean, we haven't talked about the children yet, in the report, but,
what did the report find out about children?
Well, so here it just says that almost 94% of children are eligible for free meals in 2016, 2017.
In New Haven at large?
In public schools.
Public schools. And and it is more than 1 in 4 reported some aspect of food insecurity in the New Haven public schools. And that's a pretty big number. And if we aren't going to get together and address this as a large group instead of trying to address it piecemeal or cutting state benefits and then expecting local organizations to pick up the slack, it's just not going to work. And so when I came to New Haven, I got really involved really quickly with the Food Policy Council. It was something that's a big passion of mine. And I think we're making some great strides, but there's also great strides to be made.
So until we elect Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren to the White House and deal with the structural issues,
yes.
What are some things people can do this month to address hunger in New Haven, the listeners?
I mean, I think just getting out and first off, reading the report. So I know that this report is published on CARE's website. It's also published on our website, and we've been trying to encourage every emergency food provider to put this report on their website so that when people visit them, there is something to, I kind of look at CARE as a partner in that they're providing the data. And if you come and volunteer with us or volunteer at Desk or Community Soup Kitchen or Fish and Greater New Haven, we can keep naming all of them. Go volunteer this.
So volunteer this holiday season at Loaves and Fishes at St. Paul, St. James. You can find that just by Googling, I'm sure.
Yep.
At Desk, the Downtown Evening Soup Kitchen, the Connecticut, any other stuff?
Community Soup Kitchen.
Community Soup Kitchen.
Volunteer at Sunrise Cafe. All of these are very easy to find. Fish of Greater New Haven. We could keep going on and on. But if you take the data and you pair it with a personal experience, I think you're going to understand how pervasive and big the problem is in New Haven. And we can't just continue to sit idly by and not do anything about it.
Any other parting suggestions from Lisa Santilli? You did a pretty good job right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to follow up with that statement. So what he said.
All right. What I want to say is thank you, Lisa Santilli, James Kramer, Lisa from CARE, and James from the Loaves and Fishes Food Pantry of St. Paul and St. James Episcopal Church. And thank you very much for coming, and thanks for the work you do.
Thanks for having us.
We do CARE in New Haven. and we'll deal with it until we get that White House change.
Yeah.
Special thanks to Yellow Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.